Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Ham Nation is brought to you by ICOM. For more information, visit ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation.
This is Ham Nation, episode number 311 for August 2nd, 2017. Amanda's Copper Capers. Hi, welcome to another episode of Ham Nation. I'm George, W5JDX. Bob Hall is not here tonight. Not sure where he is, but I know it's not here. So maybe Gordo or someone will know where Bob is. But we've got, well, some of the usual suspects in here tonight. Right below me here, both on screen and literally, is our friend, the world-famous alligator wrestler, Don Wilbunks.
My God, go back to that four shot. That's like a low-rent Brady Bunch, isn't it? Look at that. Oh, my Lord. Hey, I got a text from Ted Randall, who, of course, does the QSO show on WTWW. And, of course, you can listen to us right now on the big, mighty TWW shortwave at 5085 and 12.105, 100,000 watts. Man, just amazing. 100,000 watt shortwave. He says that, you know, they got the oldie show and all the ham radio stuff, but no matter what the show is, you can send information for your club, your group, or classes so that Ted can announce it. Anything that's local news to hams, ham fests, tailgate parties, new appointments of local folks, anything that's going on in the ham radio community around you, they want to hear about it for their online, on-air radio bulletin board. You can email that to email@wtww.us. email@wtww.us. So if you got anything of interest for hams, go ahead and send that in. And we got some news. I want to announce real quick the name of the 2017 Bill Pasternak WA6ITF Young Ham of the Year for 2017, Marty Sullaway, KC1CWF. We're going to try to have him on the show here as soon as we possibly can. Exactly.
Exactly. All right.
But Marty. You can come to the Huntsville Ham Fest in a couple of weeks, in the third weekend in August, and meet Marty and congratulate him himself. So there you go, George. It's going to be a big show tonight. Oh, and lots of info from Dr. Tamitha Scove, an extended segment from her. So I'm going to shut up and let somebody else yak now. Go ahead, George.
Okay, Don. Well, yeah, I'm looking forward to that report from Dr. Scove there. We're also going to have a report from, our friend Dan in 9LVS, who's looking up at the sky, too. But we'll have that a little bit later. We've got Amanda with us a little early tonight, and I know you've got a little excitement going on, don't you, a little bit later?
I do. I'm going to keep everyone in suspense. All I can say is that there were cops involved, guns, robbery, thefts. Stay tuned.
Wow. With all of that, you know, it's always an exciting show here, but it sounds like it's going to be a little extra exciting tonight. And you can tell right here because coming up next is our friend Gordo. Hi, Gordo.
Well, hi there, George, and all is well on the West Coast. We understand that Congress is getting flooded with hams sending notices saying, keep the Parity Act rolling, Senate Bill 1534. Thanks to the League for keeping us on point on that. I saw a couple of Boy Scouts at the Boy Scout Jamboree out here, and they said the National Jamboree was awesome. And the Central States VHF group said, awesome. So upcoming awesome Ham Fest would be Austin Ham Fest, August 4 and 5. That's a Friday, Saturday. The Pacific Northwest in Spokane, August 4, 5, and 6. They're doing 3 days. Riverland Amateur Radio Club Swap Meet on August 5th in Onalaska. Oh, I blew that one. Onalaska? Anyway, somewhere not in Alaska, but on Alaska, Wisconsin. This weekend is also the 222 and up contest. So if you want to make some contacts on either FM or sideband or CW, it'll be perfect timing because the Perseids meteor shower is coming up next weekend, but it's already warming up. And Piatone, Illinois has their get together Ham Fest on Sunday, August 6th. And Berryville, Virginia, their Ham Fest on August 6th. And of course, Don and the gang are getting ready for the August 19th and 20th Huntsville. Well, this evening, we're going to talk all about automatic antenna tuners, much like this one right here, that are great for tuning up long wire antennas. So, Victor, if you'll go ahead and roll the short shots, let's jump right into automatic antenna tuners. Now, we'll always say, before you go for an automatic antenna tuner, especially for mobile, go for a tuned mobile antenna. And here's the ATAS, and this is a wonderful antenna that requires no tuner. Now, for those that don't want to punch a hole in the vehicle like we saw there with Patrick's Red Mobile, they have lip mounts. And lip mounts can take either a 3H24 or an SO239 or a PL, you name it. They come with wiring kits. And the whole idea is for mobile high frequency, get that antenna up as high as possible. This is not bad. It's all the way nestled, but and I don't know if there's any other metal spots that they could go any higher. One thing I like about this, the mount on the right side, looks like it's stainless steel. Who makes that mount? And it's a goodie. Now, the ham sticks, $19, maybe $21 from MFJ and a couple of others. These are amazing performers, but if you get them up nice and high, they really shine. And they're a great way to get started for those of you just wanting to get started on the air. The ham sticks will hold on quite nicely to a trunk lip mount. Even the Outbacker, thanks Don Arnold, W6GPS, for bringing those in all the way from Australia. No longer available that I'm aware of, but that mount does it. And here's yet another ATAS mount, and this is a good one, and it's up as high as they can get it. But look at that roof rack. Wouldn't that make a great way to do a mount of a high-frequency antenna as long as you don't go under something and wipe it off? Boy, I can see a roof rack. Negative. The roof rack will introduce capacitive reactance. You see the bar that the antenna's on and then the roof of the vehicle, the red roof, that's going to develop a capacitive reactance that most radios with their built-in tuners will not be able to handle. So the roof rack looks like a great way to go, but it is extremely difficult to tune up because of that capacity between one and the other. Now, if you've got a vehicle like we have, the van, that has a big hitch, or correction, a big hinge, we recommend the hinge mount rather than the hitch mount because the hitch mount's going to be too low. The hinge, even though only half of it is making a great DC contact, you measure it. I think you're going to find that the hinge is a great way that you could put an L bracket, a real heavy one, and get that L bracket to support a high-frequency antenna. So always be thinking about trying to resonate your antenna at the antenna. And, you know, you don't have to spend $300 or $400 or $500 for those exotic MFJ antenna analyzers. I love MFJ antenna analyzers. Here's one for just about $99, and this goes through all of the HF bands. Oh, my gosh. The frequencies, how do you read them? I'll tell you how you read them. You leave your radio turned on, even without the antenna connected. And when you sweep through with this MFJ antenna analyzer, you'll hear it clearly. Whoop, whoop. And there you'll see the needle hopefully dip on the analog meter down below. So you don't have to spend $200 or $300 if you're on a budget for a good MFJ antenna analyzer. Well, George pulls up. Now, this is George, N6VNI. George is active with so many different things, with so many ham fests, including one coming up here in Southern California another month or so. And he was showing his VHF antenna, which is on the front of the vehicle. But on the aft end, he was showing his 102, actually it looked like about 122-inch stainless steel whip and a ball mount. And he was quite proud that everything appeared to be working good. On the right-hand side is the Hi-Q antenna, and of course that is motorized and tuned at the antenna. But the whip on the left is tuned with an automatic ICOM antenna tuner. Wow, pretty cool. Just a stainless steel whip. Will it perform as well as the big Hi-Q antenna on the right side? Well, we did some looking, and we discovered that he had some great little beads on it, the little RF chokes along the lead. And I reminded George, I said, George, you know that that lead is single wire, not coax. Well, he knew that. And he said, the proof of the pudding is making comparisons. And he was quite proud that that HF antenna was working great, the stainless steel one. And that's why I always recommend, as an expert ham, never judge it just by going in there saying, well, I thought the way you feed it. He's feeding it, and it seems to work well. However, I bet there's some loss with the single wire coming out of the HF tuner going to that stainless steel whip. Not coax, but single wire. Now, the ICOM AH4 is an automatic antenna tuner designed for single wire, not 50-ohm coax. In fact, if you try and hang 50-ohm coax on that ICOM, it just won't fine-tune. The ICOM tuner is not plug-and-play. As Don, N9ZGE at Quartz Fest, Don has been a regular antenna tuner expert there, showing off the difference between each one. The ICOM tuner, along with the SGC and MFJ and LDG, they're all automatic wire tuners. And we found some interesting things about the ICOM tuner that we like. First of all, it's in a weatherproof box. This one from SGC is also in a weatherproof box, but this one's about $560. The ICOM is considerably less. However, you can see the nice layout of an automatic antenna tuner. And on the left, you see the little red wire loop. That is single wire, reactance wire output, not coax. Almost all remote-mounted automatic tuners will have either a white insulator that you see on the right side, not for coax out, but for single wire. So we take out the ICOM AH4, and it comes with a cable kit, but you've got to do a little bit of soldering. In other words, it's not just plug and play. First thing is you got to open it up. Don't lose those screws. Make sure that the weatherproof little neoprene O-ring is in place. And there you'll see the tuner's coils for inductive reactants, the blue capacitors for capacitive reactants, and those little black guys, those are relays. It's all fed by a microprocessor that analyzes what frequency you're on and goes ahead and tunes in the right amount of X sub L and X sub C. Yeah, the ICOM tuner, the AH4. And when you go to work the AH4, you first have to put in the wires without any accoutrements on them. The first set of wires that you do are the four conductors for tuning it. And this works just with the ICOM, although I've heard there's conversion kits. But this is what causes, when you push the ICOM tune button, the automatic tuner to go into the tune mode, swings the radio over to AM for a little bit of signal, and in a couple seconds it triggers the radio off and you're all tuned up. Be sure and watch the color code because they are specific and it easily pokes into each one. Now the coax. Well, you've got to first put the coax through the top, and then you've got to dress the coax, and you have to use their connectors. They're PL259s, but they're designed specifically for the gray coat that ICOM makes. So dress down the outside copper braid. It's about 98% shield. Not a strand, but a single conductor, and that's fine. And, you solder the tip. Hey, everybody can solder the tip. But here is where I have found, especially a maritime mobile installation, that there's a malfunction. Not of the tuner, but of your soldering techniques. You have got to use a large 200 to 300-watt soldering iron to really get a good take on the braid going through the PL259 two or three holes. Again, this is an ICOM connector. It's a little different than your regular PL, but it does require you do an expert job of making sure that that braid is well soldered to the outside barrel of that connector. Found a lot of areas where it didn't get soldered. Okay, go ahead and plug it in. And we're ready to roll. And again, the coils for inductive reactants to make that whip that George has look much longer, or capacitors, the little blue ones there, to make any long wire look shorter if you're on the higher bands. And the black things are the relays, and underneath those covers are all the electronics to make the thing work. But take a look to the right. See that white loop of wire? That is single wire output, not coax. Make sure that, as George did, he has it well protected against the weather. He's got all of the stuff on there. Make sure the antenna tuner is well grounded and get the tuner as close to the feed point as possible. That's what George did. He's got it hidden away in the back area of that pickup truck. So the lead length going from the hot part of the antenna wire out to the ball mount is relatively short. And there again is that high voltage connection. And yahoo, that has high voltage. So when we're dealing with automatic antenna tuners for long wires, yep, they can work on, as you see the left side, N6 VNI's stainless steel whip, and they do a good job. But we're going to do more testing. We're going to remove those chokes on the feed line. They were put on thinking likely like coax, but no, it's single wire, high voltage wire, 15,000 volts. And that comes from Neon Sign Companies or down at your local marine electronics dealer. So that's the story about whip antennas. Remember, the stainless steel whip has no loading at all. So all of that loading has got to take place from the whip antenna itself with the automatic tuner. So that's the story on automatic tuners and the ICOM AH4. That really works well, but you need a lot of big whip and a lot of wire and maybe capacitive loading at the top to make that whip play. Well, let's go to the skies, and our pal Dan, who is always there helping us with the show, has an amazing review of Oshkosh and the big fly-in. So if we can go ahead and roll the video, here comes Dan and the Oshkosh fly-in.
Welcome to AirVenture 2017 and the W9ZL Special Event Station. AirVenture is one of the largest aviation events in the world, held annually in Oshkosh, Wisconsin on the last weekend in July. The W9ZL Special Event Station, located behind the museum at the old Lone Rock Flight Service Station at Pioneer Airport. The Fox's Amateur Radio Club actually had two stations. One was the Yaesu FT-5000, and the other station was an ICOM 7300. For 6 meters, we used the ICOM 756. And for making our 2 meter contacts, the ICOM 207. For our antennas, it was a vertical, hooked up to the FT-5000. And the IC7300 was connected to a multiband dipole. The Foxy's Amateur Radio Club has been doing this special event station for over 30 years. And if you contact the station and send them an SASE, they'll send you back a nice certificate. These binders contain a lot of the certificates from years past.
Okay. Hugh Lima calling CQ for the special event station in Oshkosh, Wisconsin for the EAA fly-in. Calling CQ in this name.
Indiana, you're about a 4-5 down here, buddy.
I'd
like to be up there, but can't make it this year.
Okay, Mike, you said you're Indiana. Can I get your full call sign? I just got Kilo Alpha 9. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Kilo Alpha 9, Golf Delta
Whiskey, QSL. Hello, Watch Japan. A very good afternoon to you.
QSL, Al, very nice to meet you there in Pennsylvania.
special event station is part of KidVenture. So needless to say, we had to show some kids how to use the radio as well. We even had Henry Luxem stop by. He was the last Lone Rock's flight station manager before the doors closed in March of 1983. There were several people that operated throughout the five-day special event station. Some operated phone, and some went for CW. Overall, the special event station was a huge success. From the W9ZL special event station, this is Dan, N9LVS 73.
Wow. That was fabulous. Thank you, Dan. Great job. Well, we've got more coming, and it's either going to be George or Don or Amanda, but my brain just went south. So here is...
me. I'll do it.
George.
Gordo, that was really a nice video that Dan had. A couple of things, more vintage items there kind of caught my attention, mostly hardware stuff. That big metal operating desk that they had there with the console overhead with the slope on it, I really like that. And I don't know if you noticed that tower in there, but there was a tower in the background on one of those scenes. That is an old self-supporter Blau Knox tower. Wow. We had one somewhere I used to work. Super heavy-duty tower. I assume it's the same thing, you know, that like they've got at WLW and WSM, but it's just, you know, one half of it because it's self-supporter, but super nice towers there. Thanks for doing that, Dan. Well, you know, we mentioned earlier Bob is not here tonight, but don't fret. We have some pine board action for you here. Nevertheless, well, I don't actually have a pine board, but I've got some splaining to do. Because I told you last week, we mentioned that we'll be talking about the transmitter there, and I said I need to talk a little bit about a Pinto tube. And let's explain how the Pinto works before we start explaining the transmitter. So that's what I'm going to do tonight. I've got some drawings here, and I've got some colored markers. So I think we're all set to go. You know, we've talked about the triode before. If you want to learn the basics of how a vacuum tube works, go back and watch Ham Nation episode 303 when I talked about a triode and did a basic but thorough explanation of how a tube works. And we'll just briefly touch on that here first. This is a triode. You can see there, well, we call it a triode because there's basically three elements in it. There's a cathode right there. There's a control grid. And there is a plate. Now, there's also a filament heating that cathode in there. We're not counting that as one of the elements when we state this is a triode. In some cases, you know, there may not be a cathode. The filament itself might be the cathode. So let's just begin here. We put some voltage in here at the bottom to the filaments. We heat that filament up. We have the cathode here connected to ground or nearly to ground. There might be a little resistance or and you know parallel capacitance in it there, but the cathode is generally sitting near ground. Up here on the plate at the top, we're putting in a positive voltage. We call it plate voltage. That's a pretty high voltage coming in there. In the case of the pine board transmitter, it's, I believe between 100 and 200 volts currently in the current iteration of that design. So we're sitting up here. We've got a high positive voltage on the plate. We're heating up this cathode down here. What's going to happen, once that piece of metal gets hot enough right there, it's going to start boiling electrons off of this cathode here. Well, those electrons are going to want to leave that and go somewhere. And they look and they see this plate up here at the top, and that's a positive voltage where these electrons are negative. They're going to start heading in that direction. And they're going to jump off that cathode as they're boiled off and head toward the plate because opposites attract. Well, what's going to happen there is the thing's just going to run wide open. We've got a control grid here between the two, though. And on this grid, we'll put a smaller voltage. It'll be a negative voltage. So we've got a negative voltage going in here. What that's going to do is when the electrons start boiling off, they're going to see that negative voltage on that grid, and that's going to repel them, and they're not going to go through quite so fast headed up toward the plate there or with quite as much strength. Now, we'll also, here on the input, we'll put a signal in. Let's say we put in a little sine wave there. Now, that's going to cause the grid to swing positive and negative. And that's going to sort of choke off the electron flow or act as a valve to control the electron. So when it swings high and swings low, the electron flow is turned on and off. It's not digital. It's, you know, an analog device. So it's going to be directly proportional to whatever our input signal is. So that basically is an amplifier because we're sending electrons up here to the plate and we're controlling the flow of those electrons with the signal that we're sending into it. So that's how a triode works. And it's the oldest tube out there. So it's very much used. You know, that's, we talked about it earlier when we were talking about the preamp. Now let's step it up a notch. Let's put another grid in there. Now this is a tetrode. We've got basically the same thing here. We've got the filaments. We got the cathode. We've got the plate. We've got this control grid here that we put in the bias and our input signal. But we've introduced another grid here. This is the screen grid. Now, we'll put a little voltage on this green grid right here, a positive voltage, as a matter of fact. And what that's going to do is, as the electrons start boiling off of the cathode there, this green grid here is a little bit closer to the cathode than the plate is to the cathode. And it's got a fairly high voltage on it, too. It's generally a little less voltage than the plate voltage, but still, usually a fairly high voltage on it. So this kind of gets those electrons flowing with more gusto. When they start boiling off of there, they see that positive voltage on that screen grid, and they're attracted to it, at a little bit more strength. Once they get there, they look up here and they say, wait a minute, there's a higher voltage up here on this plate. So they just go on past the screen and hit the plate. Okay, so we get a little more gain out of that tube by having the screen in there because it just helps improve the electron flow. Now, there's a little flaw with the tetrode here. And what that is, once we've got the kinetic energy of those electrons being boiled off that cathode, headed toward the plate, they're going to strike it so hard that some of them are going to bounce back down. They're not going to go all the way on out the circuit here. They're going to be reflected back toward the screen. And that's going to cause a little bit of screen current to flow as well. So we're not getting the usage of all these electrons coming off of here. Some of them are being wasted. They're going back toward the screen. Well, they got to thinking about it, and I believe it was Mullard came up with another tube design, the pentode. Now, this is a tube that's being used in the pine board transmitter. It's basically the same thing we got before. We have the filament that's heating up a cathode. We've got the plate up here at the top. We've got the control grid. We've got the screen grid that we're putting a positive voltage on to. And we've got one more grid in here. This grid is called the suppressor grid. And if you look here, it's not tied to positive like the screen and the plate. In this particular case, it's tied to ground, or it could be, it'll be a lower voltage. It won't be anywhere near the screen voltage or the plate voltage. It's going to be negative compared to those. In this case, ground is plenty negative compared to the high voltages there. So what's going to happen now is those electrons start leaving down here on the cathode, and they're headed up toward the plate. They're going to hit that plate real hard because, you know, they've got the little extra attraction there that the screen grid got them started heading that direction. And they see the plate up there and the high voltage on it. They rush right on past that screen, hit the plate. Now, instead of some of those bouncing back like they did before, when they try to bounce back, they look here and they see this suppressor grid. And it's got a negative potential. So these electrons, being negatively charged, they're not going to want to leave that plate and flow toward another negative because, you know, opposites attract. So the same sign would repel. So with this being negative here on the suppressor grid, those electrons aren't going to be knocked off and reflected back down into the tube. They're going to be more focused right on up into the plate there, which means we're going to get a little more gain out of this tube. Also, you know, there's a tendency when you've got the electrons reflecting back down in the tube, with it being pretty high gain with that screen voltage, the tube can go into oscillation pretty easy. By putting the suppressor grid in here and having it grounded or, you know, at a negative voltage, it changes the inner electrode capacitances of that tube, and it's not quite as likely to oscillate. So that's another advantage of it. There are numerous other benefits from it, and they get a little more complex. I just wanted to show you basically what each of these grids is and, you know, what its function is. So, same old tube we had before. Put an input signal in here. It's gating on and off. The electrons boiling off that cathode at the rate of the input signal. Screen voltage here on the screen grid kind of gives them a little kick in the seat of the pants as they're headed toward the plates. They're going so hard at this point with so much kinetic energy, they jump right past the suppressor grid. But any of them that would be potentially reflected back are repelled by the suppressor grid. And, of course, we've got our positive voltage we put on the plate here. Our signal comes out here. We've got to have some way to separate our signal that we're putting in from that high plate voltage there. The way that typically would be done, and it's a little more involved in this, but in the most basic sense, we would just have a capacitor coming off of that plate and would get our signal on out here. So we don't have that high plate voltage coming to the output where we're trying to connect our next stage to. So there you go. That is basically how a pentode works. And that's a tube that's going to be used in the Pine Board Project transmitter. And I believe Bob will be back with us next week. We'll be talking more about that. It's fairly interesting. You know, we've already covered the preamp and how all of that worked. This is RF. This is a little bit different. So stay tuned for that. Well, now let's get a message from ICOM, and we'll be right back because we got a lot more to go yet.
Heard it, worked it, logged it.
Contest season is here. ICOM's high performance and innovative transceivers will help you make the most out of contest season. Continue your contesting momentum with the IC7300. Ideal for the ham on the go, it's a high-performance HF transceiver with a compact design, RF direct sampling, 15 discrete bandpass filters, large 4.3-inch color touchscreen, real-time spectrum scope, and SD memory card slot. The IC7851 will give you the competitive edge you've been looking for. Raise the bar and hear what others cannot with this HF 50 MHz transceiver. Reciprocal mixing dynamic range, crystal clear local oscillator design, spectrum scope, dual receivers, and digital voice recorder. And don't forget about the ICOM IC7700 and IC7600 radios. Both of these top-of-the-line transceivers are still available and sure to be the perfect companion for this contesting season. Visit ICOMAmerica.com/amateur for more information on all the great ICOM radios. And you can tune in and enter to win after each episode of Ham Nation. Go to ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation. Register to win some great swag prizes like T-shirts and hats. While you're there, learn how you can win the monthly grand prize drawing for a new radio. And for August, that new radio is going to be the ICOM ID4100A dual band VHF, UHF, one band at a time transceiver. Does both analog and D-Star. It's the entry-level D-Star mobile with big rig features, built-in GPS receiver, full dot matrix display, micro SD card slot for voice and data storage, available Android and iOS applications. It's a great radio. You know, this is the one that is replacing the ID880H that I use. I tell you, they really stepped it up a lot with this rig right here. So go to ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation. Throw your name in the hat because somebody's going to win this. And, you know, it might as well be you if it can't be me. Thanks, ICOM, for sponsoring Ham Nation, being the oldest sponsor that we have here. Sign up. Good luck. And don't forget to follow ICOM America, Inc. on Facebook and Twitter. And I had one other thing I was going to give away here. This is a question that comes from Gordo's. Well, it's Gordo's Extra Class Amateur Radio License Preparation Manual. We asked this last week. Which of these methods is commonly used to convert analog signals to digital signals? Is it sequential sampling, harmonic regeneration, level shifting, or phase reversal? You know, this isn't the extra manual. This is a little bit harder question here. However, Ed Hoard, WX4ED, said, George, the answer is A, sequential sampling. And you're correct, Ed. So you're going to win this MFJ 113 giant LED alarm clock. It can read in both 12 or 24-hour formats. A great clock that, you know, you can even see without your glasses on from across the room. which is helpful for a lot of us these days. And I do want to mention one other thing. Thanks for that, MFJ. They're going to be having the 45th anniversary of that company coming up very soon. You know, nobody's got more ham radio accessories than MFJ. And a lot of them are made right here in the United States in Starkville, Mississippi. If you can make it, I've been to this event twice. They only do it every 5 years. I highly recommend that you go to Starkville on September 29th and 30th and join them there for their 45th anniversary and also the ARRL Day in the Park. They're going to give factory tours of all the MFJ high gain, Cushcraft, Ameritron. I can't think of all the company names right off, but they're all open with free factory tours. They're going to have free lunch. And, well, prizes a whole lot more there. But I recommend it just for seeing those factories alone. You know, you'll be amazed at some of the things they do there and how they're actually done. It's going to be a great time, and I'm certainly going to be there again. Well, let's see. What are we going to do here next? What we usually do
is we started getting curious about the news, and you know who we're going to call then.
Ghostbusters?
Oops, same difference.
Well, if I go back that far. Hey, thanks, George.
Hi,
yeah, we've got some good stuff for you tonight in Amateur Radio Newsline. But more important than that, we have an extended segment with Dr. Tamitha Scove. Remember, we talked about the Carrington class event that came off the backside of the sun, and had it been directed at us, it would have been catastrophic. She's got some additional details on that coming up right after Amateur Radio Newsline, which comes up right now. From Amateur Radio Newsline Report, number 2074, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, August 2nd, 2017. As the date for the International Lighthouse and Lightship Weekend gets closer, amateurs on Prince Edward Island are especially proud to be participating in a location that's as old as Canada itself.
Canada's East Point Lighthouse on Prince Edward Island is known as the Confederation Lighthouse, the sole survivor of the two built in 1867, the year Canada itself was established. Like Canada, it's marking its 150th year. Now the lighthouse will be gaining another distinction. It will be the location from which hams operate on August 18th during the International Lighthouse and Lightship Weekend. It will be among as many as 500 lighthouses in 40 nations around the globe, giving their best effort to make the most contacts possible over the course of 48 hours that weekend. The lighthouse will operate with the call sign VY2PLH. For Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Kevin Trotman, N5PRE.
Here's an interesting question. Just what do the world's largest radio telescopes really hear? Our man Jim Dameron wondered that as well.
Listen up. Can you hear it? Scientists in Puerto Rico can, and they think the sounds they've been picking up are signals from a red dwarf star known as Ross 128. Researchers at the Arecibo Observatory first detected these odd communications back in April and May. And the news has since been making its way around the internet. Naturally, that's led to speculation once again about alien life forms. But Abel Mendez, director of the Planetary Habitability Lab at the University of Puerto Rico, notes in his blog that space aliens aren't high on the list of possibilities. He said the source could be a burst from a high-orbit satellite or emissions like solar flares. Scientists ask for assistance from two other radio telescopes, the Allen Telescope Array in California and the Robert C. Byrd Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia. The findings are still pending. Perhaps what's really needed instead, just maybe, is simply to send a QSL card.
For the rest of this week's Amateur Radio News, please listen to the full Amateur Radio Newsline report online on a repeater near you or on shortwave radio station WTWW at 9930 and 5085 kilohertz. And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news for four decades and counting at www.arnewsline.org. With Kevin Trotman in 5PRE, Jim Dameron in 8TMW, Karen Eve Murray, KD2GUT at the news desk in New York, and our news team across the globe. I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW73. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation. Now, here's the solar update with Dr. Tamitha Scove.
We have a big corona hole that's going to be rotating into the Earth strike zone here in the next few days. That could bring us some storming. And an old region 2665 that gave us that huge solar storm a couple weeks ago and fired off a massive superstorm while on the sun's backside. That region's now rotating back into Earth view. Will there be anything left of it? Those stories and more in the news this week. Solar activity is going to pick up a bit this week. We have a big coronal hole that's going to be rotating into the Earth strike zone here in the next few days. That could send us some marginally fast wind that could bump us up to storm levels and maybe even through the weekend. But that's not the big story. The big story is old region 2665, the one that gave us that big solar storm a couple weeks ago and fired off some massive solar storms on the backside. It has survived its transit on the sun's backside and is now rotating back into Earth view. Now, we haven't gotten a really good look at it yet because it's still kind of occulted off on the limb like that. It's kind of hard to see things on the sun's edge, but it looks like it's died down a bit. And I don't blame it. I'd be tired too, firing that many solar storms. So we'll see whether or not it's still an M-flare player here in the next few days and whether or not it's still a risk for more solar storming. Switching to our M-flare threat meter, you can see as soon as region 2665 departed behind the sun's west limb, everything began to quiet down when it came to the X-ray flux, and it's remained that quiet basically the entire time that region has rotated on the sun's backside. Now that it's becoming visible again, you're seeing the pops, the little mini flares starting, and even a C-class flare. Now, things are quiet at the moment, but you can't really trust it with this region. It's now been renumbered 2670 because it's a new version of it coming into Earth view, and we'll be continuing to watch it. So you ham radio operators, you're not in the clear yet. You could have a chance for some radio blackouts. Switching to your solar storm conditions, you can see we had that moderate storm hit us back on the 16th, and it gave us beautiful aurora all around the world, and it came from region 2665, which is the reason why we're keeping a close eye on it this time around. Meanwhile, things have kind of died back down. We had a couple pockets of activity from a little bit of fast wind here and there, but pretty much things have been at unsettled conditions, and that will continue for the next couple days until this new pocket of fast wind will hit us probably around the weekend. Now let's get back to the big story, which is region 2665, and talk about what happened on the sun's backside. Now this is Stereo A, it's our backside monitor. You can see here's Earth, here's the sun, and here's Stereo A staring at the sun from behind. Now if you look and you can see, just entering Stereo's view is that big sunspot. And if you just watch it, bam, do you see it right there? It let loose a massive eruption. This is that superstorm we were talking about. You could actually see it as a big halo, even from Earth's perspective, but it was headed away from Earth, not toward us, luckily. From Stereo's vantage point, it actually caused what we call an asymmetric halo. That's because the eruption wasn't directed really toward Stereo. It was actually directed more toward Mars. Now, switching to our prediction model, ENLIL, this is NASA's version of the model because they worry about other planets other than Earth, in this case, namely Mars. You can see this massive solar storm launch from the sun, and you can see Mars is almost a dead center. Stereo A isn't even supposed to see this storm. It's supposed to miss it. Now, the fact that Stereo A actually ended up seeing this storm shows you that it was even bigger than the models anticipated. Now, there's been a lot of lively discussion as to whether or not this event is a Carrington-class event or not. And if you don't follow Halo CME and Chris Out of Space on Twitter, you really should. Now, thanks to Halo CME, we have this wonderful graphic in which he compared the Carrington class event from 2012 to this event that occurred just a few days ago on July 23rd. Now, as you can see here, you're actually looking at the Stereo and looking at the locations of Stereo as well as the direction of the solar storm, which is labeled CME, and an arrow that points where the center of that solar storm went. Now, as you can see on the 2012 event, Stereo A, which is that red dot right there, actually went almost right through the center of that solar storm. But in this case, Stereo was located way off to the east of this event, and so it barely grazed it. Now, the interesting thing that we have here is that we know that these solar storms are much stronger and much faster at the center of the storm than at the edge. And that is where the dialogue comes in. Because this storm was not fast enough to be considered a Carrington class event as it was seen by Stereo A. But if Stereo A had actually hit the center of it. So the takeaway from this is that even though this has been an extremely low activity cycle for the sun, we have seen two superstorms, one that has been a Carrington class event and one that is nearly so. And this has sparked a lively discussion in the scientific community as well, led by people like Dr. Scott McIntosh, who argue that it's actually the low activity cycles that spawn these large extreme events. Now, regarding that superstorm that was launched on the 23rd, people have asked me, if it had hit Earth, what kind of impact would it have had? And I argue that if this superstorm had hit Earth head-on, I mean a direct hit, it could have rivaled the 1989 event that caused the Hydro-Quebec grid to shut down. And it left millions of people without power for over 9 hours. It even caused the Toronto Stock Exchange to close. And all of that was before we had smartphones and GPS. So imagine what it could do today. Switching to your solar storm conditions and aurora possibilities over the coming week, we're pretty quiet right now, but we are anticipating the hit from that high-speed wind. It should hit us sometime around the weekend. At high latitudes, expect active conditions with a chance of minor storming. At mid-latitudes, probably only a chance for active conditions. This fast wind isn't all that fast, so expect it to be pretty mild overall. Although you aurora photographers, you might get a chance to see some aurora, but it just may not drop as far south into mid-latitudes as if we were strongly storming. Switching to your solar flare and particle radiation storm outlook over the coming week, region 2665 has re-entered the picture. It is now labeled 2670, so don't be confused by that sunspot number there. That is the old region, 2665. And because it's back into Earth view, NOAA has immediately upped the M-flare risk to about 20%. Right now, we're not seeing it being a big M-flare player, but you never know with this region. It's been pretty unpredictable. So expect a possible chance for radio blackouts over the next few days. We'll see kind of whether or not it grows or decays. Looks like it might continue to decay. If so, that means the risk will decrease over the week. Also, the solar flux has risen a little bit, but not all that much. So expect marginal conditions on the bands. So the space weather this week is picking up a bit. We have a coronal hole that's rotating into the Earth strike zone here in the next few days. It should be sending us some fast wind pretty much in time for the weekend. So your aurora photographers, get your shutter fingers ready. You might be able to catch a few shots. Now the big story, of course, is region 2665 that survived its backside passage around the sun. It's now been relabeled 2670, and it had fired some monsters on the backside, so it looks a bit tired now. We'll see whether or not it continues to be an M-flare player and has enough moxie to send us some more solar storms, but we don't really know that yet, so all of us are kind of on edge. So you ham radio operators and GPS operators, just be prepared for, you know, maybe some issues here and there, but right now it looks like everything's going to be pretty minor. I'm Tamitha Scove. Thank you for watching.
If that doesn't give you an idea of just how fortunate we are to have Dr. Tamitha Scove be our friend, and the fact that she does know about ham radio and she is studying for her license, that she wants to be one of us as a licensed amateur radio operator. My God, I mean, to have someone of her caliber on our team is just amazing. Dr. Scove, you're amazing, and we appreciate you so much. Just I shudder to think what would have happened, like she said, if a storm the size of that 1989 storm would have hit now with all the technology that we are so dependent on.
Wow.
Makes you think. It makes you think. Well, let's head over to the chat room now and see what is on Amanda Alden's mind. Hello, Amanda. How are you tonight?
I have a crazy story to tell you guys, and only, I don't know, copper theft. Let's start there. Put copper theft in your mind. We have repeater sites on high mountaintops in here in Colorado, and a few that are kind of easy to be accessed by other people. So let's start there. We've had a break in into one of our repeater sites for, just as far as we know, four times in the last 7 days, and they've been stealing a lot of copper from there. It's an old AT building, huge. It used to be for fallout capable. Anyhow, we started putting up cameras because we noticed every time we were going there that more stuff was being stolen and tools were being left around that didn't belong to us. So we put up a lot of cameras. Then we had alerts coming back to us saying, hey, alert on camera such and such, you have an intruder in their building. So we would watch the live camera. Now, mind you, this is still very far away from a lot of law enforcement. So it's about an hour and 15 minutes out from any of the sheriff's office people that would be coming to answer this call. Well, you guys, this morning we finally got them. After four times in the building, they were in there this morning about 4 a.m., called the SO. The SO responded, and it was crazy. We got to watch this live. Anybody that watches Cops or live PD, you know exactly what I'm talking about right now. When you watch the cops pull up on camera, there they are. The perps are inside. Cops have the guns drawn, and they come up on the door. They come inside the building, and this building is pitch black. So all you can see is the infrared on the camera. And then you start to see the flashlights kind of swooping around through the building. And then all of a sudden you see a person like this. And seriously, the cop pulled his gun out, said, get on the ground, get on. And we didn't have audio, so we ad-libbed, by the way. We can only assume what he was saying. And one of the guys ran out of the building. Guess what? Cop was waiting outside the building. Boom, get on the ground. Guy was spread eagle, laying on the ground. The other guy was inside crying to his mom. Well, maybe. I don't know. Again, we're making it up. But he was on the ground putting his hands up. He had the headlamp on. Could totally tell they're out there getting all the copper that they could. And just an amazing, amazing thing to watch live. And so that's great. They got the two guys. They had them in their vehicle ready to be arrested. They had to wait for the crime lab to come out. The crime lab comes out. We had a work party scheduled for the site today. So Jeff, my beloved Jeff, and four other hams are out there ready to work on the site to secure some more doors and to do some repeater work, right? So the crime lab person is there, and the perpetrator's car is still parked out there. Again, it's a very long trek from any kind of urban place where they would have came from, either Colorado Springs or Denver. And they're both about an hour and a half away. So the cops have the two suspects ready to go back to town to book them. They leave. Crime lab person's still there. The five hams go inside the building. They all go down to the basement to check out the damage. I'm watching on the live camera as they're doing this, and I kid you not, a guy comes out from the woods, jumps in the car, and takes off. There's another guy out there in the woods hiding from the cops. This is the scariest situation you can ever, ever imagine. Copper thieves are really crazy. They found drugs, knives, you name it. They found it on these guys. The third suspect got away. He did. He drove down the mountain road. I mean, nobody knew he was going to be there and drive away. So anyhow, you guys be safe when you go up to these remote sites. George, you know what I'm talking about. You go to transmitter sites all the time, and you never know if there's going to be a break-in, and that's why something is down or broken. Be careful going to these sites. George, have you ever ran into that where you'd find copper missing or that's why something was down?
Well, I haven't seen it that it was so bad that it took the station off the air, but yeah, I was at a site yesterday that I saw where some copper was missing, had been cut away. And I mean, they couldn't have got more than 10 cents worth of copper, just enough to cost a whole lot to replace. But yeah, say hello to my little friend.
Yeah, exactly. You guys, take a buddy, take your dog, take something. Don't go to these remote sites alone. Jeff has gone to so many up on 10,000 feet up. No cell phone service. There was no cell phone service there either. I saw that guy on our live camera. I forgot my HT today. I didn't have it at work. And I'm seeing it on my phone going, oh my God, there's someone there. There's someone there. I had to run out to my truck, jump on the radio and call anyone because I couldn't see where the guys were. I didn't know if they were in the building or if there was a confrontation and the perp took off. It was scary. It was the scariest thing I've ever heard. It was crazy. So be careful out there. Look for those kind of things. If you all of a sudden have a repeater go down, it might not just be the weather that took it out. Just beware. Be on edge. Be careful. Yep. Take someone with you. All right, let's get to some questions. I have some announcements too. This one is a really cool story. KN4DSC Chad, he says, I just got my tech in June, and he's really wanting to upgrade. But Gordo, he's taking your advice and getting some experience under his belt first, and then he's going to look into upgrading. So congratulations, Chad. Welcome to the hobby. Welcome to Ham Nation. He says this show and amateur logic is what made him want to join into this hobby. So welcome. All right. I put an announcement on Facebook about, hey, tell us about your Ham Fest. Oh my gosh, I got overwhelmed. There's a bunch of announcements, but I'm going to go over the ones that are happening this week. And the next week I'll touch on some more. So this Sunday we have Cedar Valley Amateur Radio Club's Ham Fest from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. And, that's in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. So Google that, you guys. Hopefully, if you're around that area, you can join in. I bet they'll have some great deals for you. Next question. George, I'm going to send this one to you. David, KJ4CMY, wants to know, when listening to some distant medium wave AM stations, I occasionally hear a signal flutter. Any idea what causes this?
I guess he's talking about fading, and that's generally going to be a combination of a case where you're receiving the ground wave signal direct from the station, and you're also receiving a reflection, a sky wave signal that's bouncing off the ionosphere, both arriving at your receiver at the same time. and they're out of phase with each other. So they're counseling, and they can act kind of funny like that. I have actually witnessed that a number of times on, now not on AM broadcast, but, well, I have, but in this particular case, 2 meter FM, when I would be talking with someone on 2 meter simplex, and then I start getting a fluttering sound in there, and I look up and there goes a jet overhead. And I've noticed that in more than one occasion. What about you, Gordo? Does this explanation hold water?
No, it's absolutely on target. And certainly when jets fly over, they'll bounce signals back. In fact, next week when we talk about tuning in Perseids, we're going to talk about being able to identify signals coming in from meteors that maybe bounce off of a jet. And as for shortwave, that's why in double sideband, you may actually have a fade of one or the other sidebands on double sideband. And that's why a lot of shortwave listeners will swing over to single sideband and either tune in one side or the other side. Not quite the fidelity, but nonetheless, the fading is slightly less. But George, you're right. That effect of a rapid flutter is usually caused by overhead aircraft.
Well, thanks, you guys, for that wonderful answer. I really appreciate it. And you never think about how many aircraft are over you until you're listening to AM, I guess. And 3,000 flights a day, I don't know what it is. But anyhow, I bet there's a lot of them there to hear. Next thing I have for an announcement, Bob wants everyone to know, don't forget, if you have questions about the Pine Board Project, please, please visit heilsound.com. Go to the amateur radio side. Scroll down to the bottom of the page. You're going to find a link. And you can click on that and find everything we've been through so far. There's video clips of what Bob has covered, shopping list, a forum so everyone can place their questions on there. And someone is always friendly enough to answer. So be sure to check that out as well. All right. That being said, let's go over some nets tonight. It's been a wonderful show, but now it's time to hang up here and get on the air. So first of all, we've got the 20 meter net on 14273. We have Steve W7UDI hosting that. On 7192, we have Kevin KC7FPF. Go join him there. If HF isn't your thing or you can't get on, get on D-Star. We have a net going on 14 Charlie, or we have EchoLink on D-Drop In. And that's not your cup of tea. We have DMR. So join them on TAC 311, which is going on right now. Did I miss anything, George?
No, but there's one other thing I'd like you to mention. The Ham Nation Facebook page.
I would love to mention the Ham Nation Facebook page. In fact, since I brought it up, no, just kidding. I did ask you guys to submit your HamFest there, but show us anything there. Go find us on HamNation on twit.tv. You can submit your pictures. Show us how you're doing on your Pine Board project. Ask us questions. Give us announcements. Tell us if your significant other just got their license or upgraded. We'd love to hear about it, and then we would love to announce it on the show. So that's okay, about it, George.
All right. One other web resource for Ham Nation I'd like to mention is the Ham Nation Wiki.
Oh, yeah.
There you can get all the show notes on previous episodes of Ham Nation. You can search for topics, which is exactly how I remembered, like I would remember the episode number. We're over 300. But I just went to the Wiki there, and I searched for Triode Tube. And I came up with Ham Nation episode 303. So that's how we found out when we said what. It'd be a good way for you to do it too. So go check that out. We thank our friend Dan Van Evenhoven in 9LVS for doing that for us. Well, before we go, Gordo, do you have any final thoughts for tonight?
No final thoughts, although the Perseids meteor shower is already starting. So go outside, lay down on the grass, cover the bright moon from obscuring your view, and look sort of up. And after about 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock local time, be amazed. And if you have a little 2-meter radio, tune up to the Weather Channel, 162-400, 162-55. And every so often you'll hear a bloop, and that's the Weather Channel coming in from 300 or 400 miles off of a meteor. Or next week, back to you, George.
Oh, wow. That's a great tip, Gordo. I don't think I'm going to lay out in the grass here tonight, though. We've had some reported cases of West Nile virus in the area, so not. And no, Don, I know you said earlier that you thought one time, but you had to quit. Do you have any thoughts for tonight, just as a special bonus for us?
No, not really. Just, again, congratulations to Marty Sulloway, KC1CWF, the 2017 Newsline Young Ham of the Year, the Bill Pasternak WA6ITF Memorial Young Ham of the Year. We will celebrate him coming up on August 19th in Huntsville, Alabama, 2 p.m. local time on the floor of the Huntsville Ham Fest. So if you can make it, by all means, please do. That is a great ham fest. And thanks to our friends over at WTWW, the big mighty shortwave. And let's see, Second Tuesday's coming up next week, and that's my night to be on there. So hang out with me and Ted Randall next Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Central Time on 5085 on the big WTWW shortwave. And Newsline has played on that thing all the time. He's got some great programming besides ham radio programming, some great oldies and country programming, and a bunch of other stuff. It's an amazing resource. And, you know, you can go on eBay and find some really inexpensive shortwave radio receivers for well under $20. If you don't have a shortwave receiver, you need to go and get you one, because shortwave is huge all over the world, but it doesn't seem to be that huge in the U.S. And maybe it's because, I don't know, we have everything else, all this other technology around us. But you really owe it to yourself to get into shortwave listening, because there's a whole amazing new world of radio out there, way beyond what you're hearing on your local AM, FM, and HD radio stations. So by all means, get out there and support WTWW and the other U.S. shortwave stations. And who knows, you might be able to hear some wild number stations and some very interesting international broadcasts. And just expand your worldview. Hear what's going on around the rest of the world and get their point of view. And that's all I got, George. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Don. Thank you. And yeah, one other thing on WTWW you might want to check out there is there's a program by this guy on there that plays theater music from the Ozarks.
Yeah, that Heil dude.
And I hope he's back next week. As I said, I don't know where he is this week, and nobody else mentioned it, so I guess we'll find out next week. All right. Thanks for being here, everyone. 7-3, have a good week, and join us again next week at the same time.